Welcome to the debate. You know, when you watch a massive building being demolished, the implosion looks, at least to the untrained eye, like pure chaos.
Right. It just looks like a disaster.
Exactly. There is dust billowing everywhere, concrete shattering, total destruction. But if you talk to the structural engineers who actually planned it, they will tell you it is the exact opposite of chaos.
Yeah, because the explosive charges are placed with, you know, absolute mathematical precision. Every severed steel beam, every weakened load-bearing wall, it's all calculated to bring the structure down in a very specific, predetermined footprint.
Right. It is highly intentional destruction. And today we're looking at the rubble of the current multi-front military campaigns in the Middle East and asking the exact same question. Are we witnessing a tragic, chaotic accident of unchecked military power? Or is this the precise execution of a historical master plan?
And we are answering that question today by drawing entirely from our source material, which features the analysis of Israeli journalist Gideon Levy. We're going to look deeply at his breakdown of Israeli society, military strategy, and international relations.
Based on that material, I will be arguing that the text exposes a deliberate, ideologically driven strategy of societal destruction that is firmly rooted in historical precedent. It is essentially a blueprint.
And, well, I read the exact same text and see a fundamentally different reality. I'll contend that the material actually illustrates a reactive, improvisational nation that is trapped by political opportunism and, frankly, the profound hubris that comes with uncontested military supremacy.
Look at the reality on the ground in Gaza right now. You simply can't look at this and call it a chaotic accident. When we unpack the source text, it becomes impossible to ignore the systemic, calculated nature of these military actions.
Mm-hmm.
The material explicitly states that the war in Gaza is designed to, quote, crash the Palestinian society and ultimately force the population to leave entirely.
But crushing a society and having a grand ideological master plan aren't necessarily the same thing.
They are when the destruction of civil infrastructure is the actual plan. We see a deliberate, ongoing refusal by the state to allow any civil governing authority to function.
Right.
The text points out they reject Hamas, obviously, but they also reject the Palestinian Authority and they reject an international force. This refusal is by design. Think about the mechanics of it. If you prevent teachers, judges, and street cleaners from working, you manufacture anarchy. You make the land unlivable.
I come at it from a different way. When you read the material closely, what emerges isn't a masterful blueprint, but a portrait of an absolute lack of strategy and vision.
Really? An absolute lack?
Yeah. The text explicitly notes that the wars in Gaza, in Lebanon, and against Iran are fought, quote, without any purpose and above all, without any end games.
How can you say there's no purpose when the results on the ground are so methodical?
Because the evidence presented points to a leadership, specifically Prime Minister Netanyahu, using perpetual war merely to survive terrible poll numbers. This isn't grand strategy. It's short-term political survival.
I hear you, but...
And it's enabled entirely by the corrupting force of unconditional United States military technology, which allows the state to go wild rather than execute any coherent ideological vision. They are simply living day-to-day on military dominance because they fundamentally lack any viable long-term political solution.
Let me drill down on the physical reality in Gaza, because I think the specific examples in the text tell a story of profound intentionality.
Okay.
The material describes over 2 million people living in tents for years. It highlights specific harrowing cases, like an elderly stroke victim lying on the sand without medication. Now, if the goal were merely to defeat a military opponent in a reactive war, you would immediately want to install a stabilizing civil authority the second the fighting stops in an area.
Right, a normal military operation would secure the area and establish order.
Exactly. But the fact that the state actively refuses to let anyone run civil life, insisting on a complete vacuum of anarchy, that proves a calculated design for expulsion. The text calls this the wet dream of the right wing.
To push them out.
Yes, to push the population south and eventually off the land entirely. That isn't an improvised reaction. That is a deliberate blueprint for ethnic displacement.
But look at the societal mindset the text actually describes. The material specifically notes that the Israeli mindset relies heavily on this inherent belief that, quote, we will always be able to improvise.
Mm-hmm.
If there were a genuine systemic master plan at work here, there would naturally be a vision for what the country looks like in 10 years, but the text explicitly states that the mainstream discourse does not include any thoughts about the future.
Which is revealing in itself.
Right. They are asking, what are we offering 7.5 million Palestinians? And the answer is absolutely nothing. No citizenship, no passport, no plan.
I see why you think that, but let me give you a different perspective. If a builder continuously demolishes structures without ever drawing a blueprint for a new one, the demolition itself is the blueprint.
The lack of a plan for Palestinian civil life isn't an oversight or a failure of imagination. It is the strategic objective.
So the strategy is just a permanent void?
The strategy is displacement, and the text confirms this is not a new improvised tactic born out of recent conflicts. When the text compares this to the 1948 Nakba, it's talking about a specific mechanism.
The mechanism of uprooting.
Exactly. Not just winning a military engagement, but actively ensuring civil life cannot resume so the population has no choice but to leave. The material traces this exact methodology back to the very beginning of Zionism.
But wait, how so?
Well, it explicitly implicates earlier, supposedly liberal leaders like Shimon Peres and Yitzhak Rabin, noting they started the settlement project and were responsible for more settlements than Netanyahu.
But that was decades ago.
And the mechanism is identical today. The strategy of uprooting, taking over the economy, the land, and the heritage was established in 1948, which the text notes was considered a hell of a success because 600,000 people were expelled and their villages were literally covered up with parks. The blueprint has existed for decades. You don't accidentally replicate a 75-year-old methodology.
But wait, strategy requires sustained societal support. If this is truly a multi-generational master plan, like you're saying, how do you explain the public?
What do you mean?
Well, you're assuming the populace is actively bought into this dark, calculated scheme. The text actually points to something much more mundane, commercial media manipulation. The public is currently allowing this reality because they are kept entirely in the dark by a private, commercially driven media that the text bluntly calls the biggest collaborator with the occupation.
Collaborator is a strong word. How exactly does the text say the media does that?
By systematically shielding the viewer. The material gives a harrowing, highly specific example. There was a 7-month-old baby shot in the head by a soldier in Hebron during broad daylight while sitting in a car with a grandmother and two other children.
That's horrifying.
It is. And if you are a citizen of a country, seeing that should trigger a massive societal reckoning. But how does the media handle it? The text says they frame it as a minor incident. They provide automatic justification for the army simply to please their viewers and avoid bothering them.
I see.
The media is a business. It profits from viewer comfort. When the populace is systematically shielded from the brutal reality of the occupation by commercial forces seeking ratings, they aren't complicit in a master plan. They are the victims of profound commercial and political manipulation.
That's an interesting point, though I would frame it differently. Because if you're listening to this, you might be asking yourself, how does a society physically ignore something happening right next door?
Yeah.
The text explicitly notes that the West Bank is only half an hour away from Tel Aviv by car. It is quite literally their backyard. You cannot be purely manipulated by television framing into ignoring your own immediate surroundings.
Sure you can, if the media tells you not to go there and sanitizes what happens there.
But at some point, it transitions from passive media manipulation to active, willful societal blindness. The text argues that maintaining a 59-year brutal occupation is psychologically impossible without active denial.
Right.
So they actively choose to deny it to protect their own self-image. Furthermore, the material points to the initial 93% public support for launching a war with Iran.
Which is a staggering number.
Exactly. Think about what that number means. The text compares that to North Korean polling. You don't get 93% support for a massive regional war just from watching sanitized evening news.
Mm-hmm.
You get that when an entire society has deeply internalized a narrative that military force is the only language. It's not passive ignorance. It's an active choice to victimize themselves, clinging to the narrative of David against Goliath while actually wielding regional superpower strength.
I'm sorry, but I just don't buy that. Let me tell you why.
You are placing the agency entirely on the internal psychological mechanisms of the populace, this idea that they've actively chosen this grand ideological path.
I am.
But the material overwhelmingly emphasizes that this perpetual war machine is driven by external enablers. You cannot sustain this level of willful blindness without the insulation provided by unprecedented external power.
You mean the United States?
Precisely. The text asserts that the United States is a full partner in this. The unconditional backing, the endless supply of advanced weaponry without any limits or red lines, is what mechanically corrupts the country.
Corrupts it how?
It's like handing a teenager the keys to a Ferrari and an unlimited credit card, then throwing your hands up in shock when they drive it through a storefront. The unconditional nature of the technology allows the state to go wild on military adventures because they know they aren't actually endangering their real assets.
But does the text really say the U.S. is the one pulling the strings?
It says the U.S. provides the safety net that makes the hubris possible. Look at the settlements in the West Bank. The text argues that the U.S. could end the entire settlement project with one single phone call conditioning aid.
Right.
By failing to make that call, the external enabler is what fuels the nation's hubris, creating this dangerous delusion that they are a special case, completely exempt from international law.
I'm not convinced by that line of reasoning, because the material shows us that this ideological drive operates completely independently of external advice, and often in direct, stubborn defiance of it.
Defiance?
Yes. If this was merely about a state leveraging uncontested American power because they have a blank check, why does the state continually push projects that demonstrably fail?
What do you mean by that?
Take Iran. The text explicitly states that Netanyahu's life project against Iran has totally failed and is unachievable by force. Yet they continue to push for it. They continue to bombard Lebanon, specifically as a tool to sabotage any diplomatic agreement between the United States and Iran.
Wow.
If you are just a state taking opportunistic advantage of a powerful benefactor, you don't actively sabotage your benefactor's diplomatic goals in the region.
You do if you're desperate to stay in power.
But it goes beyond just one politician. The text points out that for decades, the U.S. has pushed for a two-state solution, and the state has done everything possible to ignore and sabotage that idea. This reveals a fierce internal ideological rigidity that goes far beyond simply utilizing American weapons. It is driven by an isolated, deeply entrenched conviction that the world is against us.
That's a compelling argument regarding their defiance, but have you considered the explicit political opportunism outlined in the text?
I have, but I don't think it outweighs the ideology.
Well, the material notes that Netanyahu is doing terribly in the polls, and quote, here he comes with another war, war after war. The text questions what the recent bombardment of Beirut actually achieved mechanically, concluding it achieved absolutely nothing except provoking ballistic missiles in return.
So why do it?
Exactly. This cycle of violence isn't advancing a grand ideological scheme. It is the flailing of a political leader who cannot afford to admit that his life's project regarding Iran has failed.
Mm-hmm.
To admit failure would be to admit that pushing previous U.S. administrations to pull out of international agreements was a historic mistake. So the military apparatus is utilized not to build an ideological future, but to delay political accountability in the present. The text literally describes this as an ongoing war without any justification, motivated heavily by personal career interests.
While the text does acknowledge those personal political motivations, it explicitly states, quote, I give him more credit because I think he has an ideology, a very dangerous one.
Well, sure.
The political opportunism might dictate the timing of certain strikes. Maybe you bomb Beirut this week instead of next week because of a bad poll, but the overarching architecture of the conflict remains fiercely ideological.
But how does an ideology survive when the entire world is pushing back?
By rejecting reality entirely. We see this in the text discussion of the global response. The source notes that the state has completely given up on the world.
Right, they don't care about the UN.
Exactly. When global public opinion shifts, they immediately label any criticism as anti-Semitic. They refuse to pause and ask, did we do something wrong? This isn't just one politician scrambling for poll numbers. It is a profound societal conviction that they are the chosen people, that they know better than the international community, and that the only language the Middle East understands is maximum violence.
That's a very dark assessment.
It is. The complete erasure of civil society in Gaza, the emulation of the 1940 Nakba in the modern West Bank, these require a multi-generational ideological commitment that absolutely dwarfs simple political survival.
But even if we assume this internal ideological conviction exists, even if they truly believe they are executing a master plan, the mechanics of it rely entirely on the absolute certainty of foreign enablement.
How so?
Well, the text notes that Europe's public opinion is fiercely hostile, yet European governments are paralyzed waiting for a green light from the U.S.
Right, which proves the U.S. shield is effective.
But it also proves they are entirely dependent. The material warns that if the U.S. conditions its aid, which the author predicts will happen within months, not years, the state will face an existential challenge it has never encountered before.
Mm-hmm.
This reliance on an external sponsor is so total that the text describes the current state of affairs as a level of dependence which we never faced before. You cannot execute a masterful, generations-long ideological blueprint when your entire capacity to operate can be shut off by a change in administration in Washington. That is the very definition of a reactive, dependent posture. It is militaristic hubris built on a foundation of borrowed strength.
Yet, when asked what the state will do if that foreign support is withdrawn, the text provides a chillingly ideological answer. The radical right-wingers, the settlers, they say, "We will fight with our hands."
Fight with their hands?
Yes. They are fully prepared to continue this trajectory even without the massive technological advantage because the ideology supersedes the logistics. It is a mindset that cannot even process the concept of a shared future.
Fighting with your hands is rhetoric, not strategy.
But it translates to real-world sabotage. The text points to the total failure of international initiatives to rebuild. It mentions the grand launching of a resort hotel in Gaza, intended for Israelis, which was totally destroyed in a war 2 weeks later. It mentions the tragic failure of international food aid lines.
Mm-hmm.
The destruction of these international diplomatic and commercial efforts isn't accidental collateral damage. It is a systematic rejection of any reality that doesn't align with their singular ideological mandate of total control and eventual displacement.
I actually think the mention of those failed international initiatives proves my point perfectly.
Really?
Yes. The reason those reconstruction efforts fail, the reason a hotel is destroyed 2 weeks after it's planned, is precisely because there is no grand plan. There is only a reactionary military reflex. The text notes that launching a war will always be more popular than signing a peace agreement.
Which is tragic.
It is. But that isn't a strategy. It's a societal pathology heavily reinforced by political leaders who only know how to react with overwhelming force. When the text warns that the nation is heading into very dark alleys, it is describing a tragic cycle of opportunistic militarism. It's a nation completely devoid of a long-term vision, blindly lashing out while unconditionally supplied with foreign arms.
As we bring this discussion to a close, my position remains that the source material clearly reveals a nation executing a long-standing, deeply rooted ideological strategy.
Right.
The continuous refusal to allow civil infrastructure to exist in Gaza, the direct and conscious echoing of the 1948 Nakba's tactics of displacement in the West Bank, and the profound, willful psychological denial chosen by the populace all point to a deliberate design. This is not mere improvisation. It is a calculated effort to dismantle Palestinian society entirely, driven by an ingrained belief system that actively rejects diplomatic compromise.
And I maintain that the text portrays a fundamentally different reality, a nation suffering from profound militaristic hubris, entirely devoid of a long-term vision. The wars being fought are purposeless and reactive, sustained not by a masterful ideological blueprint, but by the desperate political opportunism of its leadership and the corrupting influence of unconditionally supplied foreign arms. It is a state improvising its way through perpetual conflict simply because it lacks the capacity to envision a political endgame.
Regardless of which framework we apply, it is clear that both our perspectives find convergence on one deeply troubling point. The text paints a grim picture of a society heading toward what the author calls dark alleys, operating without any sustainable vision for its future or the future of the 7.5 million Palestinians sharing the land.
Absolutely. Whether we view this conflict as a calculated ideological continuity or a tragic, reactive cycle of militarism, the end result described in the text is a profound lack of an endgame. Examining the text through these dual lenses allows us to see both the historical mechanisms at play and the immediate, gritty political realities driving the day-to-day violence.
There is certainly much more to explore in this material, particularly regarding the complex historical echoes of 1948 and the rapidly shifting landscape of international diplomacy that sustains it all. But it brings us back to where we started. When you look at the rubble, the absolute dismantling of a society, when the dust finally settles, you have to ask yourself, are you looking at a tragic accident of unchecked power or the precise execution of a calculated design?